Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
Interview with Andrea Phillips, a.k.a. The Revisinator.
I'm Julia.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Mike.
And our special guest today is Andrea Phillips. Welcome, Andrea.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
So, Andrea, you have a book that just came out, Revision. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what the book is about?
My book, Revision, is about a wiki where your edits come true, sort of. Obviously, when you're writing a story like that, you have to put some hard limits on how it actually works. Otherwise, things get out of hand really quickly. But basically, this is a sort of genre-bending, almost chick-litty sort of science fiction thriller-y kind of snark modern book. I totally just didn't sell any of you on it, did I?
Well, I'm fascinated. I haven't read the book yet, but I did read the description of the book, and you basically mentioned the thing that I'm most intrigued by, which is that there's a wiki-style editor that you can make things come true with. And I'm intrigued by this because I also see the book is built as science fiction and not fantasy. So how does that work?
How does it work? I don't even know. This is one of those existential angst kinds of questions that I have as a writer. Because I write a lot of things that are kind of at an intersection between magic and technology, like computers that do magic, basically. And so this is science fiction because I wave my hands and I call it quantum physics. As long as you have science-y sounding names, then it's science fiction, right? If it's using computers and electricity, it's science, even though it's not anything remotely grounded in real science. It's dressed like science, so it may as well be. But I was trying to find another term for it at one point, and I landed on science fantasy for a little while, and then I realized that it's Star Wars, and this is nothing like Star Wars. So, alas, wrong label.
All right. So you mentioned that it's a little bit chick-litty. Originally, we were going to have a panel discussion about science fiction and romance, but then most of our panelists fell through, and so now we're kind of in the in-between space, occupying half-panel, half-interview space. So I know you prepared for the romance panel, and I know that your book kind of doesn't exactly fit it, but sort of does. What's your experience with science fiction romance in general?
I love romance in a book. I'm an unashamed reader of plain romance novels, not even paranormal romance, just straight up romance. And I really love reading science fiction that has a strong romantic element to it. But interestingly, for this book that I wrote, I didn't want to go there. So there's a lot to do with relationships in this book. One of the most important relationships is between the main character, Mira, and her boyfriend, who becomes her fiancé in the first chapter. And I mean, that tells you it's chick lit right there. There's an engagement in the first chapter, right? Even though it doesn't go on to any of the chick lit tropes after that. And I didn't want to go the straight romance path either, because then you're kind of ghettoized, and there's this idea that it wouldn't be taken seriously or legitimately as science fiction at that point. You look at a writer like Sharon Shin. Are any of you familiar with Sharon Shin?
I am.
I certainly know the name. I haven't actually read any of her books, but I know lots of people love them.
Yeah, I got to be on a panel with her, and she was awesome, but I haven't read her work.
Oh my gosh, I bet she is awesome. So yeah. She's written this series of books about angels, and it's basically angel science fiction romance. I mean, these are straight-up romance novels. And they're also really, really definitely science fiction. It has to do with sort of genetically engineered beings and computers and satellites orbiting the planet. It's not even Earth. And absolutely all of the stories have to do with romances between angels or between angels and people. And I mean, it's not angels as in from heaven in a religious sense, but she's built this sort of world mythology where there is a religion based on these angels. It's derived from a computer program. These books are fantastic, and they don't get anywhere near the sort of play that I think they deserve as works of science fiction, because the most important threads in them are romantic. I resent this, actually. I resent this very much.
Okay, so that's a really interesting thing you bring up, and one of the reasons why we have both Sean and Mike on is because originally Sean asked me if I wanted to lead this panel on romance because he knows that I like to read romance, and I do. I like to read romance, and I mostly read romance that doesn't have any science fictional elements because it's my special leisure reading genre that I read when I want a break from all the things I do in my daily life with work. And so I said, sure, but you know, I want to have some men on this panel because I want people to realize that men are actually interested in romance, that it's not just for women. So I had Sean and Mike, and I know Mike's been reading a little bit of romance lately and is interested in learning more about science fiction romance. But Mike, do you want to talk to me a little bit about why you started reading romance and what your experience has been with it? And also if you kind of agree or disagree with the things that Andrea just said about Sharon Shin's books, for instance, being taken less seriously because of the romantic element?
Sure, yeah. So I've been a fan of romantic comedies in film and in television for a number of years, you know, since I was a teenager, and a lovelorn teenager with not much of a love life, and I would watch romantic comedies and aspire to the better parts of them, and then I leveled up my feminism and realized how pretty terrible some of them are. But even with that, I've continued to appreciate not only romantic comedy specific, but just the overall necessity or strong inclination to including love as a part of the storytelling universe, because it's an important, romantic love specifically is an important part of so many people's lives, though not necessarily everyone's. And being a person who is interested in love and romance and all the things that go along with it, I've been trying to be more active in seeking out works that specialize in doing that thing. You know, I've read science fiction and fantasy books that have romance plots, and I've written books that have had romance plots, but I'm not as well read in the name that I've read, you know, less than six books that are romance and then something else. And you know, almost everything that I read is something else with a romantic element. And as a result, my understanding of the genre, even though I've been seeking out information and gone to panels at conventions, is still all very limited. And I know about the kind of the tropes mostly informed by romantic comedy films. But, you know, I started reading, I read a lesbian romance that was called Month of Sundays, which was very fun, about a chef and an accountant. And what I found in that was that it was very much the same style as romantic comedy. And that was incredibly inviting to me. And it was cool to see the ways in which that it spent more time on the tiny nuances and, you know, reactions of sentence by sentence and body language and just digging incredibly deeply into the relationship as deeply as a science fiction book would dig into like the physics or a fantasy book would dig into magic. So that's been all really exciting. And I definitely agree with Andrea that there is a stigmatization, both from the genre world, looking at things like paranormal romance or romantic romance science fiction or fantasy romance, where the romance is the primary category and then the speculative element is the secondary or supporting category in terms of shelving and such. And I think that a lot of that just comes down to straight-up patriarchy, where women's work and women's stories or stories that are regarded as women's stories are denigrated, both from a science fiction community standpoint due to overall sexism, but also very much from a literary standpoint. Personally, I've sometimes been kind of pushed back or feel like I wasn't welcome in romance books just because of the form of covers, because it's so many topless dudes. But that's, you know, that's just kind of a, that's as much of a trope as urban fantasy books with sexy ladies in hot pants. So it's just something to get over on my own part.
Okay, so wow, that was a lot of really interesting stuff, and I'd love to unpack some of it. But the one thing I'm going to say before I call on Sean, who I see has a hand up in the chat, is that if you are interested in learning anything about the history of romance and why those covers are what they are, and what covers have been like in the past, I would really recommend Beyond Heaving Bosoms by Sarah Wendell and Candy Tan. Sarah Wendell is one of the people who runs the blog Smart Bitches Trashy Books. And they've just, it's a really fun read. It's nonfiction and it's all about the history of the genre. So highly recommend that one if you want to get into the history of it a little bit more. So very Sean, cool. you have a hand.
Yeah, well, there were like 900 things Mike brought up, but I'll just focus on the two because, so the first one, which is the stigma thing, I think the stigma does still exist, and it was something I was going to bring up with Heather Massey, because when I just Googled, like, science fiction romance, I was just seeing what was out there. I found two posts. I found Heather Massey's blog, and then I found something from 2010, which is about science fiction and romance by Heather Massey. And in that particular post in 2010, she talked about how people were perceiving romantic elements in science fiction novels and how there was this kind of weird stigma where if there's too much romance, people would just felt like it was too much, like, this is not what I want anymore, and they would kind of, like, this is a girly kind of thing. And then what was interesting is when I looked at her blog just yesterday, today being the 6th, so the 5th of May, she had another post about a publisher who apparently was asking an author, which is not named, to change the plot of their story to remove too much of the science fiction elements, because the argument being that the audience for the kind of book the author was writing would not be able to handle the science fictional elements. I don't know anything about the particular book, but I'm guessing it wasn't hard SF and didn't have, like, quantum physics equations in the pages, right? So I'm assuming it was, you know, like what we would typically think of as science fiction. It's got spaceships and faster than light travel and aliens and that kind of stuff. It just happened to be oriented around a romantic plot line. So I feel like it's a question I really wanted to ask, and now I don't know if we can get to an answer, which is how much has it actually changed in that span of almost 5 years when that is still something being discussed? And I don't know. I mean, I'm not in that community, but it is a question that maybe somebody listening could answer, because it is kind of worrisome that there is this kind of weird divide going on. And then the other thing I did want to note is it was a thing that I was thinking about before we got to recording this, which is how to even quantify what science fiction romance is. And Mike had brought this up, right? That there's romantic subplots all appear in almost any science fiction. I mean, you could just, like, look at any major media property. There's some romantic subplot somewhere, right? It may not be a big deal in the movie, but it's there and it's noticeable. But I don't know how much that actually qualifies as being science fictional romance, because I feel like the romantic element has to be kind of the guiding force for the plot. Whereas if it's like a science fiction story with some romance in it, it's still the sort of whatever the science fictional plot, or, well, maybe not so much plot, but whatever the genre it's trying to operate in, like action or whatever. So, but that was something I was thinking about, is how to quantify that, because I think to myself, I'm not a science fiction romance reader, and yet, I love romantic subplots in, like, almost all of my science fiction. So, yeah.
Okay, so, Andrea, I see that you have something to say in response to this, so why don't you take it away?
I have a book to recommend to you. It's Agnes and the Hitman by Jennifer Crusie, and it's not science fiction. Actually, I believe it's by Jennifer Crusie and Bob Mayer. Now, Jenny Crusie is a fantastic romance writer, and I recommend to you any book she's written. And then Bob Mayer is a kind of an action, even men's adventure kind of writer, as I understand. So they collaborated on a couple of books. And Agnes and the Hitman is an amazing, perfectly balanced combination where the romantic plot and the action plot are this the same thing almost. It's amazing because you can't call it a straight romance and you can't call it a straight action either. I mean, because if you look at science fiction, I'm thinking about books that I've read, you know, Lives of Dow and, you know, the Miriam Black books and so on and so forth. And they actually all have really substantial romantic threads to them, mm-hmm. right? But they are background and you could cut them out without the core of the book being completely demolished. The story would still stand up, right? It's not a load-bearing plot point. Whereas in something like Agnes and the Hitman, if you cut the romance out, there's no other story anymore. There's just nothing really there. And I think in order to call something science fiction romance rather than vaguely romance-infused science fiction, you have to reach that point of significance to the plot where it couldn't be routed around if it failed, if it were just vanished from the story. This is my feeling, at any rate.
Well, that I think that makes sense to me, because if you flip it around and apply it to any other genre, a story is only a mystery if the mystery element is so load-bearing that without it, it's not a story. Science fiction, the same.
Yeah, certainly. And within romance, there are so many different subgenres. So you have romantic suspense, which is something where you're going to have a lot of action. Maybe you're going to have a killer and they're trying to solve the mystery or catch him. And then you have things like historical romances where the thing is taking place in the past. And then within historical romance, it could be romantic suspense or comedy or who knows what. And what I've found is that when I talk to other romance readers, it's kind of rare to find someone whose tastes exactly overlap with mine. There are so many different kinds of readers, and you can literally go into the tiniest subgenre you want and stay there. So you can be someone who specifically only likes to read Amish erotica, and there are books for you. That is not my preferred subgenre, but those books totally exist. So this is the kind of thing that when I think about what makes a romance, to me, it's got to have the romantic plot as the main thing going on, and it's got to have a happy ending. But you can have books that have a strong romantic element that don't necessarily have a happy ending. And that's where you get into things where people will call them things like chick lit or women's literature. And Andrea, I noticed that you said your book is chick lit. Did you think of that in terms of not having a happy ending, or did you think of that in just feeling more like other books that you would put in the same category?
When I say it, I actually mean it in a matter of tone more than anything else. Because if you unwind the plot, aside from the fact that there is this engagement involved, it's not a chick lit plot in any way. It's a really pretty traditional science fiction plot, or even a thriller plot with the sort of the secret that someone is trying to unravel and then decide, you know, whether something good or bad is going on. It's the quest to find the truth. And that's not a chick lit plot, really. But the tone of it is really aggressively feminine. It's a really, really womanly voice, if you will. I feel like you don't see a lot of that in science fiction. Now, there are definitely writers that are using an aggressively feminine tone in their work. I know Merle Lafferty has done it. I know Mary Robinette Cowell has done it. But it's not common. And so I say chick lit not because it is chick lit, not because it adheres in any way to chick lit tropes, but because it has that feeling of something by and for women.
Okay, and so I see Mike has a hand, but before I come to you, I'm just going to jump on something Andrea said, which is Mary Robinette Quill using that very feminine tone. And I would say that the first book in the glamorous histories, Shades of Milk and Honey, would count to me as a romance. The rest of the series is more fantasy, and we get to follow the relationship of a couple, which is really cool, but it's, even though there are very strong fantasy elements in all of them, and I would consider all of them fantasy, I would consider the first one also romance. The other thing that I thought of when I was trying to think of whether or not I'd read science fiction romance before was the Cordelia's Honor omnibus of Lois McBatcher Bujold, which sort of follows the story of Cordelia, who is Miles Vorkosigan's mother, meeting his father and falling in love and marrying him. And there's a lot of other stuff going on in those books, but that romantic plot is so central that I feel like that to me would count. But it's hard because in some ways I think these categories are there as marketing categories to help signify to readers who are looking specifically for science fiction that these books are science fiction, that we don't think about whether or not they're romance. And it can be very difficult to differentiate, for me anyway. So, Mike, what were you going to have to say?
Yeah, just speaking as an outsider from the kind of romance and category romance standpoint, is there a functional difference between romantic comedy style romance and chick lit?
Okay, so that's a really interesting question. I would say yes and no. That chick lit could encompass books that also fall under the romance umbrella, but doesn't have to. So a lot of times if you get chick lits that are also romance, that would be like a romantic comedy, and that's where you get something like maybe Bridget Jones's Diary. But you can also have chick lit where it's not necessarily a romance, and you can have something like Sophie Kinsella with her Shopaholic series, where you know there's a very romantic thread in them, but also it's often following the same couple from book to book, and you're seeing their problems, and it's not necessarily about the romance getting together and working out in the end. The focus might be on something else.
I'm also thinking of Marianne Keyes and Rachel's Holiday, which is definitely a chick lit book, and it's really a just completely crushing novel about addiction and about fooling yourself and then about recovering. And it is definitely chick lit. It's definitely marketed as chick lit. But this is a really serious novel and not really a romance at all, even though it is about relationships and about how drug abuse can destroy your relationships.
That's a really good example. I think Marianne Keyes writes a lot of things like that. Another author that I would think of as writing more women's fiction, but not necessarily romance, is Maeve Binchy, who writes a lot of books that are usually set in Ireland and sort of follow a group of friends or acquaintances. And they have very relevant stories to women's lives and a very sort of tone that a lot of women find comforting, but also can tackle really difficult subjects and don't necessarily have romantic plots.
Cool. Thank you.
So Sean, you have a hand. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it kind of bounces off something that, Andrea, you had said earlier about one of the books you'd mentioned, which involved drug addiction. And I know in another interview you had talked about the fact that your main character is, I think your word you said was like somebody who just makes all of the wrong mistakes like possible. And I didn't want to have you just rehash your answer there. I was actually going to kind of thinking in terms of like, what do you think is a value to characters who fail and perhaps even miserably so?
I think it helps to build compassion. This is something that I got out of Rachel's Holiday in particular. That book just wrecked me for a solid couple of weeks after I read it, because a great writer brings you into a mental space. A great writer teaches you how to be that other person, and then you kind of have to live with the consequences of being that other person for a little while, which is fantastic when that other person is Thor, and being Thor is pretty great. But when the person that you're pretending to be in fiction that you're reading about is someone who's made bad choices and is suffering really terrible things, that's difficult to read. And then you take that difficulty back with you to the real world, and it sheds light on how you view real people the rest of the time. So I think there's a value as art in having that difficulty present in fiction.
Okay, so how does this all relate back to science fiction? Do we see, can anyone think of any science fiction or fantasy books that have this kind of sensibility, but are also categorized as science fiction or fantasy, and that we wouldn't necessarily call romance?
There's a webcomic called Questionable Content, which I think mostly as a romantic comedy, but it has robot companions and artificial intelligence. So it's clearly a science fictional setting, but it's entirely relationship-based, romantic and friendship relationships. But definitely counts as science fiction because there are intrinsic SF-nal characters, but it's shock through with romantic storylines.
That's a really good one to bring up, Mike. I've read Questionable Content, and indeed, it does have robots, and I don't always think of it as science fiction, but it kind of is because they're little sentient bots running around.
Yeah, and one of the AI companions has become a more central character in the last couple of years. So I think that's foregrounded more of the SF-nal aspects for me.
That is a very good point. So I know that we don't have Heather Massey, who was probably going to be our biggest expert on science fiction romance as its own separate genre with its own separate community. But I'm wondering how much any of us actually knows about that. Has any of us read science fiction romance, or were any of us aware that there was a separate science fiction romance community that was specifically looking for romance with science fictional elements in it?
I mean, I think a lot of that winds up being urban fantasy, doesn't it? Rather than science fiction, it all goes toward it, or at least it's a lot easier to find Twilight or even, you know, Mortal Instruments, this sort of YA and romantic area in fantasy rather than in actual science fiction. I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't know why it is either. So, Sean, I see you have a hand, and if you are going to badmouth Twilight, I'm going to tell you not to do it right now. I find that there are all sorts of things that people can pick apart about Twilight, and that's completely valid, but it's been done to death. And the fact is that it is a story that has spoken to millions of readers, some of whom read it when they were younger and are now adults and now kind of look back on it and sort of roll their eyes and sort of think about how much they loved it as teenagers. And I think that every book that brings readers joy is doing something wonderful and sometimes can open the door to other things, and sometimes it's doing a good job. So I will defend to the death anybody who likes Twilight for their right to like it and not be judged for that. And I think that it is problematic and that there are plenty of people out there, including all of us, who probably like other problematic things too. So, but with that caveat, go ahead and say whatever you'd like to say.
Well, I can't say half of what I was going to say anymore. You just cut my legs out from under me, Julia. Thank you for that. I don't disagree, by the way. I think if you can like whatever the hell you want. And I don't have to like it, but you can like it. And that's cool.
And on the subject of Twilight, I will say that I will recommend a blog post by Ferret Steinmetz, who is an angry robot author, and who read the first Twilight book, which is Twilight, and wrote a nice post about why he thought it worked for people and why it was so popular. And I was like, you know what? Ferret hit it on the head. And I did not actually make it through Twilight. I tried to read it and it wasn't for me. But there are a lot of books out there that aren't for me, and far be it from me to tell other people that they shouldn't read them.
If I may, New Moon is actually a much better book. I wound up reading them for business reasons, believe it or not. And Twilight is what it is. And then New Moon and Onward actually are really pretty great in their own right. I will see this in public.
That's awesome. I'm the person who has, like, on multiple panels, smacked down people for trash-talking Twilight, just because I know that there are also plenty of people out there in the audiences of those panels who love those books, and why do we need to judge them for that? But that said, like, I've watched all the Twilight movies. I find great joy in watching those because they are ridiculous.
And from a broader sense, the success of the Twilight books underwrote hundreds, if not thousands, of book advances and book deals for other writers.
Sure.
This is spoken by someone who would know.
Yeah. So when a big book hits like that, that serves as the big tent pole that creates opportunities for other experimental works and debuts. So anytime there's a big phenomenon, I say hooray, because it means other people are going to get work.
All very good things. I've never read the books. I've only seen the movies, which could be terrible for reasons that have nothing to do with the books.
I mean, I think that we can agree to disagree on the movies. I find the movies hilarious.
They are kind of hilarious, I'll give you that. In any case, I don't know what I was going to say before, because I think we got on a totally different track, so I've lost it.
Well, I think there's something we could pick out of Twilight, if we may, is the idea, and I see this as a romance trope, and may be incorrect, the idea of insta-love, or that incredibly overwhelming romantic relationship that kind of then defines the rest of reality, which, from what I can tell, seems to be the case more or less both for Twilight and for 50 Shades of Grey, to look at fairly recent phenomena. But then, you know, if we look at something like Divergent, the romantic plot in that is also incredibly important, and there's a very strong instant relationship, and it seems like that's something that's a bit of a through line for at least romantic plots or romance categorized speculative fiction.
Yes, and romance readers will argue over this forever, if you let them, about whether or not insta-love, which they call insta-love, is a thing that they like or dislike. Some people really like that trope, some people really hate it, and you will find romances that have the hero and heroine meet each other and not be in love instantly. I was just reading Julia Quinn's book On the Way to the Wedding, I think it was, where the hero and the heroine meet. He sees a woman at a party and he knows instantly that she is the one for him, and he is super into her. And her best friend, who is used to kind of being overlooked, is just rolling her eyes because this always happens and it's never actually love. And her friend doesn't ever care about these guys. But she knows that her friend has been involved with this guy that's not really good for her. So she decides this guy is actually better than that guy, so she'll encourage him. And then, as it turns out, the best friend who's overlooked, who's encouraging this romantic entanglement, is the heroine of the novel. And she and the hero fall in love, and he eventually realizes that this instant attraction he had for the other woman isn't actually based on real depth of feeling. And that's the kind of thing that you can see that in a romance novel, because romances exist to explore emotional relationship landscapes in all kinds of different ways.
I think you see a lot of it because it's intended for younger readers too. And I don't know about you, but when I was a teenager, I felt things really immediately and incredibly powerfully. So I didn't have that sort of insta-love in seeing someone across a crowded room and needing to be with them forever. But I could spend 10 minutes with someone and then crush on them incredibly hard.
And I think that's true for a lot of people, especially when you're going through all of those hormonal changes, and teenage years are so hard anyway and everything's intense. It's easy to feel at that point like everything is a life or death situation. So, Sean, I see you have a hand.
Yeah, I just want to kind of add you know, I won't say that I'm a romance reader. I mean, I am with Mike. I really like romantic comedies, which are great, I think, for a lot of reasons. But I do think one of the interesting things about romantic plots, even if they're just subplots, is that there are sort of templates, but then there are all these, like, really complicated, messy, weird ways in which romance sort of presents itself. Like, it's not always the same kind of relationship we see, right? There are all these different methods that authors and creators use to sort of present romantic plots, and they're not all good, right? They end, some of them end horribly, some of them maybe don't end horribly, but they don't end well. They're just kind of not what people expected. And I like that, I think, because there's something about romantic elements that seems like a really good way to get at the heart of people, to get at the how we work inside, the way in which our feelings, you know, enact and actualize, which maybe isn't always as present in other ways. And I feel like in some cases you can even have the romantic subplots, or even the overarching plot, being the mechanism of exploring other aspects of the character, right? Because you can have characters who experience traumas, and where they actually present that is in their relationships with other people, not, you know, in this kind of immediate after the fact moment where they just kind of like, oh my gosh, I'm traumatized, right? They act out with their loved ones. So I feel like that's something that's really, really fascinating about that, and makes it a particularly strong type of story that you can tell, whether or not it's the overarching story or something smaller within.
Yeah, okay. So I feel like there's a lot of science fiction that does actually explore romantic relationships in interesting ways, even when the main through line of the story is a science fictional plot. One of the things that I'm thinking of is John Scalzi's Old Man's War series. I don't know if any of you have read that.
Yeah, just the first one.
Well, that whole series follows the main character whose wife has died before he signs up to get into the Intergalactic Army, and then he discovers that what happens when you sign up for this is that if you die beforehand, they take your DNA and make a clone of you. And so then he kind of ends up trying to find the woman that they've made out of his wife and getting back together with her and building a new relationship with her, who she's kind of the same person and kind of not. And it's a very important story throughout the series. And I think that that's something that it's a place where you can examine stuff like, what is it that makes someone you love? And that's a question that we might have. Sean, I see you have a hand.
Yeah, another book that kind of deals with some similar ideas, although not as strongly in the plot, is The Forever War, where the further and further our main character gets removed from the world he came from, right, the sort of contemporary world, the more he becomes disconnected from the way relationships even work in his world. So, of course, the people he attaches to are going to be the people who are most closely connected to his past. And he does, at the end of the novel, how many people have read? You all have read Forever War, right?
I haven't, actually.
Alas, no, I've been meaning to.
Oh, okay, I'm just going to ruin the sort of ending. Damn it.
Okay, what, do you guys mind if Sean ruins the ending?
Shoot.
La la la, I can't hear you.
Okay, so, I won't ruin it. I don't think
you should ruin the ending, Sean.
Something happens at the end that involves stuff. God, that's terrible. In any case, just towards the end of the novel, like, it's constantly dealing at various stages with romantic entanglements, because it's a military novel. But as we get towards the end of the novel, the main character, I mean, he's like 300 something years removed from his own time, and so his culture has changed so much that what he recognizes as relationships with other people, even romantic ones, doesn't exist anymore. So, and I find that that's one of the fascinating things, if I think about that book, is the way it represents social change and the effects it has on people and their relationship with others. So,
And that reminds me of Octavia Butler's Xenogenesis series, which has a great deal of focus not only on romance and relationships, but also on kind of the biological changes and syncretization between species. And I think that's definitely something that a science fiction romance can investigate, is use the literalization of the metaphor approach, as Chip Delaney describes, to reframe how we think about relationships and romantic love.
Oh, you just made me think of something. Marianne Mohanraj has I think it's a novella, or almost novella, in How to Live on Other Planets. The anthology came out, I think, last month. Which is actually about, it's a science fiction romance about a trio of, I guess they'd be called polygamists, it's in the future where this is more acceptable, who they go to an alien world and their relationship gets sort of, I don't know how to quite say it without ruining the book, but in any case, there's some struggles with their very complicated trio of relationships, and it's actually a really interesting story. I mean, it explores not only, you know, how this relationship functions, right, as a relationship between a man and two women, right, the way in which they take on different roles within that relationship, how it deals with, for example, raising children, right, because there are three of them that haven't figured out how to fuse all of the various materials together, so, you know, that creates its own problems. But it's an absolutely fascinating story. I mean, it deals with slavery, all these kinds of things, all at once in this one, what is essentially it begins as a sort of straightforward romantic plot and becomes much more complicated as it gets along, because you get these different tiers of romantic interest. So
I find it really interesting that you said, I guess you'd call them polygamists, and that's okay because it's the future, because I'm pretty sure what that is a polyamorous triad, and that's a thing that exists today. And in fact, Marianne Mohanraj is publicly out as being polyamorous and has a husband and a boyfriend long term.
Oh, so I didn't know that.
It's actually something that within science fiction fandom circles is not entirely uncommon. There are plenty of people who you've probably met at conventions and just hadn't realized were polyamorous.
Harking back to the Heinlein days.
Yeah, I think why I said polygamous is that, if I recall correctly in the story, they actually are officially married and licensed as the trio. But I mean, I get what you're saying. I'm just, that's why I went there, because otherwise I think I would have been very confused.
Okay, yeah. So, and I think that that's another question that a lot of people who are polyamorous sort of talk about, whether or not that's going to be legal as more than one couple being married to each other. So there are some people who have had their own ceremonies, the same way that there are gay couples who had gay marriage ceremonies before marriage equality was gaining ground.
Well, and of course, when you deal with the landscape, and for example, the United States, I mean, we seem to be much more forgiving of gay relationships, but polyamorous relationships are ones in which people might be interested in marrying more than one person. We're kind of like, no, never. I mean, granted, it could change, who knows, but it's interesting.
And that's the sort of thing we can explore in science fiction, right? To sort of map out what those social mores and relationships would look like on a broader scale than we see them today.
So, yeah. Andrea, you mentioned Heinlein. Do you want to go back and unpack that a little bit?
I was just thinking about Heinlein and Stranger in a Strange Land, for example, was a really influential book in fandom in demonstrating the kinds of relationships that people can have. I mean, it's a sort of free love, groups of people who are in a, I'm going to get the terminology all completely wrong, so I apologize in advance.
So he had line marriages, where you would be, you could be married to a group of people, and as the older people started to, you know, die off and stuff, you'd still have other people in the line who are married with you, and the idea was you're not alone, which is, I think, comforting to people. And also, he was very much a proponent of the, like, you could totally get it on with multiple people, and I think a lot of science fiction fans really liked that idea.
Yeah, and the idea of belonging to a family, a group of people who are yours, who are your adults even, beyond necessarily a romantic relationship, but who were all safe for a romantic relationship if you wanted that also. it's interesting to reframe that in terms of families and not necessarily romances, I think.
Yeah, well, and a lot of what I see with polyamory, especially when people are living together in a blended family situation, is the idea of wanting to have more adults around and wanting to be able to share the stresses of child rearing and bill paying and household chores amongst more than just two people.
Yeah, I am a parent, and it can be incredibly isolating and lonely to be the parent of a small child and there are only two of you and you're only home at the same time, you know, 3 or 4 hours of the day, really, beyond sleep time, if you can get it. So I definitely see the appeal of having, you know, another one, two, three people around just to help the household run.
Okay, so Mike, I saw you had a hand a while ago.
Yeah, I wanted to toss out another story that had come to mind for me that I see as very much being a romantic or kind of family relationship first, and that's Viler Kafton's I'm Alive, I Love You, I'll See You in Reno from 2010, which I think I read in the year and just totally rocked me. And what I loved about it was not only the very intense personal relationship, but the way that it spanned all of these technological changes and how each change was reflected in how the two were able to relate to each other. So it used the romance frame to inform how the science fiction worked, and then also reflected that back from the speculative onto the personal.
Right, and that one was, I believe, Nebula nominated that year, so obviously something that spoke to a lot of people. Andrea, you asked, does Mass Effect count too? And Mike says a resounding yes, and I also will say a resounding yes. Go ahead and talk to us about Mass Effect.
So I think in terms of science fiction and romance, the place where it's at right now is video games. Mass Effect is... I should back this up. BioWare is, I think, one of the finest purveyors of romantic fiction in the world right now. And that's not just because they have romantic threads, but because the romantic threads that are happening to you. So it's not just that, you know, Morgan or Garrus or whoever is having a romantic relationship and you can enjoy the romantic feelings. It's that they are gradually falling in love with you and they're saying all of these wonderful fuzzy things to you. And it's an incredible emotional dynamic that it's really hard to get in other kinds of media. But it's also really, really interesting how it creates this sort of feeling that you've been through these things in the future together. It really is a completely different level of romantic storytelling than you see anywhere else. And because video games are so grounded in genre, basically what you get are incredibly genre-infused romantic stories. I love this to pieces. I'm a big fan, I have to say.
So Sean asks, is that the one where the character is gay in the second game?
There are many BioWare characters where many... I'm sorry, many BioWare games where many characters are gay. In Mass Effect, you know what I see? And I'm having difficulty untangling in my memory which characters are in which games. But BioWare tends toward giving you choices, even if you are gay. I think even in the first game, there are gay relationships available.
Yeah.
The difference is whether they're initiated by the character, whether you seek them out, right?
Yeah, Liara is bisexual or pansexual and interracial pansexual throughout the series. I think the first male-male relationship option comes up in the second Mass Effect game. Is that correct?
I think that might be true. I have not actually played these games, but I'm just trying to remember what my friends who do were squeeing about and when, and I think Mass Effect 2 did have the first male-male one.
I mean, Liara, the pansexual, is sort of an issue. Not the character, but the species is sort of sexually available and interesting to everyone. And yeah, They're the female aliens. And I have issues with that for obvious reasons, yeah. But for what that's worth. But BioWare gets better and better at this stuff as they go along, so I'm trying really hard not to hold that against them.
Awesome. I think it's a really interesting observation that in that situation, these characters are saying that to you as the player. I know, Andrea, you've written for some other games that, for instance, you've written for The Walk, which was a fabulous game that I have recommended to everybody I can possibly recommend it to, which is a game that you unlock story segments by walking, and the story is fed to you in audio clips where people are talking to you, the person who is walking, who they call Walker, because they don't know your name. And I think it's a very different and personal experience that sort of really makes you feel like you're part of the story, as opposed to passively consuming a movie or a book that isn't about you doing something.
You know, there's something about the audio format in particular, too, that's very intimate. People whispering in your ears when you're wearing headphones. I think it's arguably more powerful, more primal than any video content is, and certainly than anything written.
That's an interesting thought, and that makes me think of the recent movie with the guy who falls in love with Siri, basically.
Her. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that is a great movie.
And that's science fiction romance right there.
It is.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, that whole entire movie is about him developing a relationship with an AI. Yeah, you're right. It's a beautiful film.
And there's certainly a subthread of science fiction stories about humans falling in love with AI or robots. You know, that I could certainly categorize that as at least a tale type within the genre, but clearly both SF and romance.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's pretty common. I mean, even Blade Runner, problematically as it does, I mean, essentially has... Well, I don't even know. Maybe it's not a romance. I don't know what to... Yeah, anyway.
I would not call Blade Runner a romance, but it does have a romantic element. I think there are a lot of science fiction stories with romantic elements. And I think that we've been primarily talking about those. We're getting close up on an hour, so I want to kind of wrap things up. But before I do that and give Andrea a chance to tell us where we can find her work, I wanted to give a shout out to Heather Massey, who was supposed to be on this podcast and couldn't make it. But she has on her website a page devoted to links where you can find other romance science fiction websites. And one of them is the SF Romance Galaxy Awards, where they give very specific awards. So I was looking at the 2012 archive, and they have awards for Best Alien Fertility Festival, Best Alien Hero, Best Battlestar Galactica inspired Romance, Best Channeling of Django Unchained in a Steampunk Romance. And so it seems like what they're really doing is picking out books that they really loved and then giving them a very clearly special award. Best Depiction of Reality Entertainment in the Future. But there's obviously a whole segment of readership out there who's looking for romance that is science fiction romance, but primarily romance. And I think that this is a community that I have never been involved with, and I'm not sure any of us have. And I think there are probably a lot of these books that are out there that I haven't read, and I kind of want to. So I'm making a list of the things that were recommended in this conversation, and I'm also going to put a link to the Science Fiction Romance Galaxy Awards page that I just read the things off of, so that if people want to go and check these out, they totally can.
Hooray.
So that's going to probably take us toward the end. I see that Sean has one last question, so I'll give Sean and Mike both a chance to have any last words.
Sure. Is Bicentennial Man, would that be considered a science fiction romance?
I mean, I think that that's definitely a story with a strong romantic element. It's billed as science fiction. I think it probably counts for me as romance, but I'm not sure if readers of science fiction romance would count it or not.
Okay. That one came to mind immediately because I was thinking about, you know, his entire journey towards personhood is tied up in his romantic interest with, I've forgotten the name of the character.
Susan Calvin.
Right, yeah. So, I don't know, I need to rewatch that movie. The John Williams one, which everyone seems to hate. Not the John Williams, sorry, Robin Williams. You get what I mean. But anyway, I'm sorry, I'll shut up now.
So, Mike, did you have any last words to add?
Yeah, for me, I'm very happy, very excited to have all these recommendations. One other question, especially if it can be answered shortly, and perhaps not if it would take a while, is there any way other than reviews to get a sense for science fiction romance or romance more generally to gauge where the sexual content level is expected to be in order to set expectations? Because I opened a science fiction romance and it was a bunch of eroticism right on the first page. And I didn't know that going in, and it does set the expectations. But coming in as a new reader to this genre, if there's any additional signposting mechanisms, visual content, you know, like visual coding on covers or anything like that, I'd be very happy to excited to hear about it.
Well, I don't know about science fiction romance specifically. I do know that in regular romance as a genre, generally there are sometimes tells in the wording on the blurbs. Sometimes there are cover tells. So, like, usually if you're going to see something with a guy who's topless, you can guess it's going to have some sex in it. If you see something where everybody is very, very nicely clothed and maybe, like, dancing at a ball, it's probably going to be sweet, which sweet means that there is no sex on the page. There may be implied sex, but it happens off screen or off the page. But if something on the blurb talks about sexy or steamy or scintillating, those are all keywords.
Fiery.
Yes. All of that is signaling to you that there's going to be sex in here. And like the hotter the word, and I'm talking about like temperature, the more likely there's going to be graphic sex.
Cool. That's a good gauge. Thank you.
But yes, reviews are a fantastic way to find out, because if you look at reviews, often 1-star reviews will tell you everything you need to know, because they'll have people who say on Sweet Romances, this has no sex in it. I came to read sex and there was no sex. Or the opposite. If there's a steamy romance, somebody might say, oh, this book was terrible. It was full of awful sex scenes.
17 scenes. There are people who will count they in will review count. How many pages of sex there are and tell you in the review.
These people really are invested in finding out exactly how much sex is going on and telling you exactly how bad it is. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Mike, I have one question for you before we go. And that's, I know you've recently started reading romances. Have you found any that you particularly liked?
Well, there was the Month of Sundays that I mentioned, and I've picked up a couple others. Last year at Balticon, I met PJ Schneider, who's a writer who works in several categories, and I've got a book or two of hers that I know are romance with speculative elements. But I've also been going to places like Book Riot to get recommendations, because some of their contributors will go through, because I'm especially looking for LGBTQ romance so that I can have a better sense of male-male desire and female-female desire to round out my experiential framework in other media, which is entirely heterocentric, right? So that's kind of been what I've been looking for as first among equals in terms of content.
Okay, well, if you're looking for LGBTQ romance, one that I would recommend as super fun romantic comedy and fantasy is Promises, Promises by L.J. Baker. Which is basically a D&D-style quest story with a lesbian main character and romance as the heart of the story.
Cool.
And it's hilarious. So, like, if you enjoy all of the D&D-style kind of a party of adventurers goes out and, you know, the farm boy makes good, it's sending up all of that. Yes, I enjoyed it very much, and I recommend it to anybody who likes those tropes. And again, that's Promises, Promises by L.J. Baker, and I can put that in the show notes as well. Okay, so Andrea, tell us about where we can find you and your work online, in person, in hard copy, in video games. Just tell us what you got.
My books are available at a fine internet retailer near you, I guess. If you want to find me on the internet, the place to start is to go to Twitter. I'm on Twitter at ANDRHIA. And from there, you can get a link to my blog. And from my blog, you can get links to basically anything interesting that I've done in the past few years. On top of that, I will be at Phoenix Comic Con at the end of the month, in case any listeners will be there. I would love to say hello and give high fives. That would be cool. I like high fives.
All right. So your website is?
My website is AndreaPhillips.com with two L's. There's another name, but I couldn't possibly get you to spell it. Deus Ex Machinatio, which is a pun in Latin. And I highly recommend you never name your website a pun in a hard to spell Latin phrase.
Okay, and just to clarify, AndreaPhillips.com is A-N-D-R-E-A and not A-N-D-R-H-I-A.
You are correct. I've got to start doing that.
All right, well, thank you so much for talking to us, Andrea.
Thank you for having me. This has been very fun.
And everybody who's listening should go pick up Revision now and read Andrea's science fiction novel, which she compares to Chick Lit. And thank you, Sean.
Yeah, not a problem.
How does it feel to be on the receiving end of that thank you at the end of the show, Sean? Does it make you feel awkward?
You know what? My life is awkward. So it's normal.
Because it always makes me feel awkward, but you just had that same like, oh God, what do I say in response to this? And thank you, Mike.
Hooray, more reading.
All right, and since I'm not as awkward as Sean, I'm just going to end it right here and say, thanks, listeners. We'll talk to you next time.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.